This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we are talking with George Nikas, Executive Director of Wilderness Watch. George has been a public lands and wildlife activist for more than four decades, serving the past 26 years as Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, a national organization dedicated to the protection and proper stewardship of the lands and waters in the National Wilderness Preservation System. So welcome, George. It's great to be talking with you today. So get us started and talk about Wilderness Watch.
What's unique about it?
Sure. So as your listeners are probably aware, back in 1964, Congress passed the Wilderness Act. And as part of that act, the purpose of that act was to set aside parts of our national forests, our national wildlife refuges, our national parks, and our BLM-administered lands, to set aside some of those lands as wilderness. Wilderness being the most protective land designation we have, and these areas were set aside to remain wild forever. So since then, Congress has continued setting aside areas as wilderness, and we now have about 111 million acres in 44 states that are wilderness. And lots of people, lots of organizations work to try to get new areas designated as wilderness. But, about 30-some years ago, a number of folks who were interested and concerned about what was happening to these areas once they were set aside. And it was great that Congress said they would remain wild and great that they told the agencies to manage them that way, but were they actually doing it? And, you know, it turns out that, you know, a lot of these areas, even though they were set aside to be protected forever, they weren't necessarily being preserved. And so a citizen organization started that would look after and serve as watchdogs of the wilderness system to make sure that these places that were supposed to remain wild forever and be preserved for present and future generations, that they would in fact remain protected and preserved. And so that's where Wilderness Watch got it started, as that citizen advocacy organization for the National Wilderness Preservation System. So we've been doing this for about 35 years, and it's a great calling, it's a great challenge, but it's worth it because wilderness lands are the finest, most protected lands we have, and the wildest lands we still have. So that's what we do.
And the wilderness areas are all in either in the National Park System or National Forests or BLM, is that right?
Right, or in the National Wildlife Refuges.
That's
right.
Okay.
Public lands. So yes, they were all public lands when they were designated wilderness, and of course they still are.
So you have multiple agencies that you have to deal with.
Yes, we do.
All right. Well, that must be a nightmare. But are they all cooperative?
Well, you know, it's like any time you're dealing with big bureaucracies, you get a real variety of folks that are helpful and concerned and responsive, and you get some who aren't. And I think that's sort of the nature of the beast. I think it's fair to say that over time, the commitment to wilderness and good wilderness stewardship and protection has diminished pretty much across the board in all four land management agencies.
So was the Wilderness Act controversial when it was enacted by Congress back in 1964?
It was. It was very controversial. And in fact, the agencies who were charged with administering these areas after they were designated, they all opposed the wilderness bill. They didn't really want to have wilderness under their purview. It's not what they did. And eventually they came around, but that was largely because President Kennedy, the wilderness bill was being sort of finalized during his time. You know, it took 8 years to get the wilderness bill through Congress, But President Kennedy's Secretary of Interior and his Secretary of Agriculture were both big advocates of wilderness, and they sort of put the thumb on the agencies and said, now we're going to have to support the wilderness bill. And they helped push it through Congress. It was, you know, it was very popular amongst the public, and it actually passed Congress with very few dissenting votes.
It was bipartisan.
Bipartisan as you could get.
Uh-huh.
And most wilderness bills were, until probably more recent times, were pretty much bipartisan affairs. So the idea of wilderness has always been popular, but there have always been, you know, very strong special interests, powerful, politically connected special interests who oppose wilderness. And that made it always difficult to get a bill passed. But amongst the general public, it's always been a wildly popular idea.
Mm-hmm. So what is the National Wilderness Preservation System? Is it a formal entity, or is it just what you call the number of wilderness areas collectively?
Well, yes, the National Wilderness Preservation System is made up of all the individual wildernesses that are part of it. And today there's something like 800 individual wildernesses, and they're found in 44 of the 50 states.
Wow.
Now, half of the system is in Alaska, but there is significant wilderness in many other states. And like I say, all but six states have wilderness. And those six states probably don't have any public lands, federal public lands within them. So they aren't likely to ever have wilderness areas.
Right.
And there's actually one wilderness in Puerto Rico. I don't want to forget that.
But they are mostly in the West and Alaskans on.
Yes. Yeah, the majority of the lands are in Alaska.
Are the national marine sanctuaries considered part of the National Wilderness Preservation System?
They are not.
They're separate. Okay. So what are the threats today to the wilderness designations?
Well, I would say the threats to wilderness itself are not entirely different than they were 60 or 70 years ago when the wilderness bill was being debated and fought over. And that is, you know, one of the really amazing things about the Wilderness Act is that it represented a statement on behalf of the American people that we were going to leave some places alone, that we were going to let nature be, that we were going to allow natural processes like, you know, weather and the like to determine predator-prey relationships, all those sort of things to determine what conditions were like in these areas the way they were before, you know, humans started walking the earth, if you will. Those were the forces that were at work here. And some places we were going to leave undeveloped, and we just weren't going to try to work our will on them. We were going to let them be. And it's, you know, I like to call the Wilderness Act Nature's Bill of Rights. And that was the first time that a society, certainly any Western society, had made a statement like that, that we were going to let some places be. That idea, that whole idea kind of runs counter to the way humans seem to function, where we are constantly trying to exploit resources for our benefit, often at great expense to the environment and to other species, sometimes maybe not at such great expense, but still, we're always trying to manipulate our environment to our benefit. And the idea that we would just leave some places alone was hard for a lot of people to accept. And I think it's especially hard for people who are in natural resource management fields. You know, I went to forestry school too, and you know, we're trained from that time on that we should go out there, that we know best, and we need to go out there and manage nature. And that idea that we would take sort of a hands-off approach, or we would be, as the founder of the Wilderness Act wrote, we would be guardians, not gardeners, really runs counter to the way sort of our our human institutions function. And so that made it very hard for a lot of people to accept the wilderness idea and the wilderness ideal. And just because we passed the Wilderness Act doesn't mean those attitudes changed. They haven't for many people. And so a lot of what we face in trying to preserve wilderness today is to convince especially the federal agencies, but certainly state agencies, state wildlife management agencies in particular, to let nature be, to let things go, to sit back and watch and learn from them. One of the great values of wilderness is to science as to how nature functions. Let's sit back and watch it and study it, but let's not try to intervene and manage it and redirect evolution, et cetera. And that continues to be, I think, the biggest challenge we have to preserving an enduring resource of wilderness forever, because it just runs counter to where we are today. But flip that around, and it's also the greatest opportunity for wilderness to teach us the value of having a different, more respectful, less exploitive attitude about nature, about the world around us, about the whole environment. You know, our exploitation model has got us in all kinds of trouble, and you don't have to look very far today or wait very long for the next superstorm to hit, the next drought to hit, the next, you know, this sort of climate chaos we're entering into is a perfect example of what happens with this unhinged sort of idea of human exploitation, the biodiversity crisis we're in, the loss of species. You know, we're in what a lot of biologists call the sixth great extinction right now. All of these things are the result of a human attitude that the earth is just here as our big storehouse of resources to exploit. And wilderness says there's another way. Doesn't mean everything has to be wilderness, of course, but it can teach us a lot about a less impactful way of interacting with our environment. And so wilderness has incredible promise, and a lot of that promise is just kind of the flip side of what threatens wilderness the most in those attitudes. Another big threat to wilderness is the loss of the ability within the agencies to actually administer these areas without wanting to invade them with modern technologies, modern machines, and all those sort of things. Because one of the things the Wilderness Act did is it mandates that these federal agencies preserve the wilderness character of all of these areas. And at the same time, it's part of how it says that will happen, it's very prescriptive. It says, you know, there shall be no motor vehicles, no motorized equipment, no mechanized transport, no structures, no installations in these places. And it has some exceptions, you know, for very rare situations. And part of that is to say, look, let's take a different approach to these places. If you need to do work in them, we'll do work kind of the old-fashioned way. We'll do it by hand. We'll use cross-cut saws instead of chainsaws. Mm-hmm. We'll use pack strings instead of helicopters. We'll backpack in. You know, we won't take motor vehicles in. And we'll experience and administer these areas in contrast to the way we're doing the rest of our lands. And agencies are having an increasingly hard time with that. And part of it is just that we're, you know, as technology advances forward, the people in these agencies don't have the skills they used to have to administer these areas in the way the Wilderness Act says they'll be managed. And so they're increasingly we're seeing proposals to use helicopters to haul stuff in wilderness. We're seeing proposals to use bulldozers to do work that could be done with a pick and shovel or whatever. We're seeing all kinds of, you know, reasons. We're seeing agencies try to open airstrips in wilderness so people can fly in there. So there's those kinds of threats as well. but I think it all kind of goes back to this idea of restraint, where we aren't willing to practice the kind of restraint that the Wilderness Act calls for.
So is there...
Go ahead.
Situations that require negotiation and compromise?
Well, you know, I suppose we go through our lives involved in negotiations and compromise, and yes, it does happen in wilderness too. But one thing we don't compromise is the fundamental tenets of the law. Within what's legal, there is often room to discuss alternative solutions, alternative ways to do things. But we don't compromise the law because the law itself was the compromise.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Wilderness Act said these are the places we're going to set aside for these specific things. And if it's not wilderness, it's managed in a different way. We don't want to start divide. You know, that sort of divided the baby. Now we don't want to keep dividing the baby even further. You know, the compromise was in the law itself, and it has some exceptions in there. You know, for example, livestock grazing is allowed to continue in areas where it was existing at the time they were designated as wilderness.
Uh-huh.
Well, livestock grazing has all kinds of impacts on the values of wilderness, but the livestock industry is a powerful lobby, and they got their exception into the Wilderness Act. So the challenge now is, how do we administer livestock grazing in a way that least impairs the wilderness? So there's room in there for trying to figure out some better solutions than all or nothing. There were some exceptions built in there for mining. And even though the Wilderness Act did change the mining laws, it's one of the few statutes that has ever changed, the 1872 mining law, which governs mining on most public lands, still, if you had valid claims, existing claims that are recognized as private existing rights, there is the potential that we could see mining in wilderness. And we've fought a few mining proposals over the years. But again, those are some of the places where you might say there's room for compromise. Recreation. What are the group size limits going to be in wilderness? How much impact from recreation use are we going to allow? There's all those kinds of decisions, you know, have room for a variety of answers, et cetera. But if it comes right down to things like helicopters versus hiking or helicopters versus horses, no, that's not one where there's room in the law for exceptions, or recreationists using snowmobiles or mountain bikes or permanent fixed anchors for climbing. The Act says there shall be no in those instances, and that's what the law is, and that's what it should be. And so in those cases, there isn't a lot of room to negotiate.
When those discussions take place, does Wilderness Watch have a place at the table?
Usually we do, even if it means that we sort of have to force ourselves into the room. We try to have a place at the table. And, you know, we're a membership organization. We're a citizen organization. We're just made up of people like all of the listeners out there. Citizens who care about wilderness have joined together in this organization. And so when we learn of a project, whether it's we're being notified by the agency or we're being notified by a citizen who says, hey, look what's going on here. When we learn about that, we get involved in those public involvement processes that the agencies have set up, and we notify our members and supporters of those issues and say, if you want to have your input as a public landowner, if you will, these are your wildernesses, here's how you can get involved. And so we provide that kind of information so that citizens, and we do news releases, all those kinds of things to inform the public about what's going on so that citizens can have a say. And of course, we we write comments and we get engaged in those issues. And if we think that wilderness is going to be damaged, we'll sometimes file administrative appeals or objections, or if necessary, go to court to try to make sure that the wilderness gets protected.
Is scientific research allowed in wilderness areas?
Yes, it is, absolutely. And if, in fact, you know, even the person, Howard Zonizer, was the person who actually wrote the first wilderness bill and was the chief lobbyist getting the Wilderness Act passed. And he worked at that for almost a decade anyway. And Zonizer, you know, used to say that scientific research is probably the highest value of wilderness. And so it is. It's a great opportunity to learn. The challenge is that research also needs to be done in a way that respects all the values of wilderness and doesn't compromise it and adheres to the prohibitions. And wildlife research in many cases it's great. It all works out great. But in many instances, researchers want to have exceptions. They don't want to have to hike in to do their research. They want to take in helicopters. One of our longtime board members and advisors who's passed away now, a guy named Stuart Brandborg. Brandy was very active in getting the wilderness bill passed. But Brandy was a wildlife biologist and a researcher who used to spend days and days and days and weeks down in the Salmon River country watching mountain goats and studying mountain goats and watching their every move and writing about what mountain goats do and the lives of mountain goats. Well, you know, now a lot of mountain goat researchers want to swoop in a helicopter, dart the mountain goats or get them with a net, run in there, stick a radio collar on them, and go back to the office and watch the data come in and try to describe what goes on in a mountain goat's life that way. Mm-hmm. They don't want to spend that time out there. But that's the difference, I guess, between wilderness research and non-wilderness research. And so in wilderness, it just asks that we do things a little differently and with a little less impact on the landscape and a little less impact of those values. But lots of research occurs in wilderness, and I would agree with Zonizer. I think it's one of the greatest values of wilderness is it gives us a chance to sit back and watch how nature responds to all of the changes that are occurring so that we can understand better what's going on with our management practices outside of wilderness.
So tell me about the Protecting America's Rock Climbing Act. Does that impact the Wilderness Act?
Absolutely. And it's another one of those things when we talk about sort of broader threats to wilderness. Some of those are coming from recreation interest groups, which don't think that their particular recreation activity should be held to the same standards as everybody else's. And the Protecting America's Rock Climbing Act is kind of a misnomer because rock climbing is allowed in wilderness, and it's going to be allowed, I think, for as long as any of us are alive and beyond.
It's a proposed act. Is that right?
Yes, what they're actually trying to do isn't protect rock climbing per se, but they're trying to make it so that rock climbers can use fixed anchors, which generally, for the most part, are bolts that they install into rock faces to make climbing easier and safer, et cetera, et cetera. But the Wilderness Act prohibits leaving behind stuff like that. It prohibits installations. It prohibits structures. And they want to have an exception in the act for rock climbers who want to use these permanent fixed anchors. Now, most rock climbers use removable protection. and it serves pretty much the same purpose, but some climbers want to have fixed anchors. They feel safer with it, or it allows them to climb places that they couldn't climb without it. And so in order to get that allowance, they're asking Congress to change the Wilderness Act to make an exception for climbers. And, of course, we're opposing that, as are dozens of other citizen organizations that have written to Congress and asked them to not do that. And a lot of climbers included do not want to see fixed anchors allowed in wilderness either. It's become quite a controversial piece of legislation, and it would be an amendment to the Wilderness Act. And it's bad enough on its own, in part just because, you know, it does result in all of these fixed anchors in places, but also because it kind of strikes at the heart of what the Wilderness Act talks about with regard to restraint, that we're willing to just accept nature on its own terms and visit it, but not try to change it. And, you know, when we start operating under a different principle than that, then eventually we'll lose wilderness. And there are other recreation interests that have wanted exceptions for their use. Some in the mountain bike industry, mountain bike interest groups have been pushing to amend the Wilderness Act to allow for bicycles in wilderness. All motorized access, mechanized access has always been prohibited. There are others that have pushed legislation that would allow, there was one bill called the Sportsman's Heritage Act, which would allow anything that was used for hunting, angling, or recreational shooting to be allowed in wilderness. So ostensibly you could drive off-road vehicles in wilderness if you were hunting, snowmobiles if you were hunting. There are all kinds of, you know, interest groups out there like this, special interest groups who would love to have exceptions to the Wilderness Act for their particular interests. Now, all of them rely on everybody else living by the rules that are in the Wilderness Act, because they want it to be wilderness when they get there.
Right.
But they don't want to have to. They don't want to have to own up to those same rules. So anyway, the so-called Park Act is out there, and it's moving through Congress right now, and there are a lot of us who are trying to encourage Congress to step back and say this isn't about protecting rock climbing. Rock climbing is allowed. This is about compromising the Wilderness Act for a very, vocal but minority user group. And we're not going to do it. And that's what we're trying to convince them to do.
Well, George, I'm afraid we have run out of time, but we're going to continue this next week with another interview. So I appreciate your talking to us today, and we'll look forward to doing it next week. Our guest today has been George Kess, the Executive Director of Wilderness Watch in Missoula, Montana. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.